This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The vaccination program is not just about saving lives. It is also about saving the economy.
That's Zimbabwe's finance minister, Mithuli Nkobi, on getting 2 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine from China. Details coming up. Also, former South African President Jacob Zuma's last-ditch legal effort to avoid jail has been tossed out by the country's high court. And South Sudan marks the 10th anniversary of its independence from Sudan. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Egypt and Sudan pressed the UN Security Council yesterday to help resolve their dispute with Ethiopia after it began filling the reservoir behind its grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, GERD, for a second year in a row. Security Council members backed African Union mediation efforts and urged Ethiopia, Egypt, and Sudan to resume talks on filling and operating the giant hydropower dam on the Blue Nile in Ethiopia. Tunisia proposed a draft resolution calling for resumption of negotiations to reach a binding agreement within 6 months that would be voted on after 1 week of deliberations. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed the meeting with Ahmed Fatih, managing editor of the American TV News and a UN correspondent who just received President Biden's call to service award for his service to the U.S.
The Security Council did hold a special meeting on the request of Sudan to hear their grievance against Ethiopia with the construction of the GERD, the Great Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, because it's impacting directly its share of water as a downstream country. Egypt is in a worse position in that dilemma because if the project of the dam will go through, they will lose over half of their water income from the River Nile that's been flowing for millennia. They will not be able to provide for the basics for 40% of the population that is employed in the agriculture sector. There is deliberate stagnation in the situation by the Ethiopians. Negotiations have been taking place for continuous 10 years with no result. What the Egyptians want, the Sudanese want, with the Ethiopians, is to remain within the declaration of principles that one of the principles was cooperation and equitable distribution of the water. If the Ethiopians will continue on their path, the outcome would be disastrous in many forms. As far as the Tunisian resolution is still in deliberation among the member states. If they would approve it without any vetoes, from the five permanent members, China especially have issues with cross-border rivers and water distribution with its neighbors. So I know they are going to be extra careful in the language of the resolution and what's its implication, since it's going to be establishing a precedent.
Egypt and Sudan both called on the UN Security Council to help resolve the dispute after Ethiopia earlier this week began filling the reservoir behind its Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam for a second year. Ethiopia's Minister of Water, Irrigation and Energy, Selassie Bekele, told the Council, "We urge our Egyptian and Sudanese brothers and sisters to understand that the resolution to the Nile issue will not come from the Security Council. It can only come from good faith negotiations." What was the impression that he left with these words?
He didn't really leave a very positive impression, because if you take it at a face value, the negotiations have been going on for 10 years. His remarks were focused that this is what it is. They have to learn how to live with it. And that, of course, is not acceptable in this time and age. The procrastination and the stagnation and the, after extensive negotiations that took place in Washington under the auspices of former Secretary of the Treasury, the World Bank, they reached an agreement that was acceptable by the Egyptians, by the Sudanese, and it was responding to the Ethiopian demands, but Ethiopia refused to sign. Ethiopia doesn't want to be legally binded, and they are insinuating that they will sell the water to the Sudanese and Egyptians, similar to the rich Gulf states are selling them the oil. And that will really represent a huge threat for international peace and security, not just for this part of Africa, but because it's going to establish a precedent.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, told the Council, a balanced and equitable solution to the filling and operation of the GERD can be reached with political commitment from all parties. She said the Biden administration is committed to provide the necessary support to reach an agreement. Did she elaborate on what kind of support the U.S. can offer?
She indicated that it's going to be technical and financial. The United States government was involved in the negotiation. It's the United States government interest to keep peace and security in this part of the world where it has vital interests. The United States government cannot force Ethiopia or Egypt or Sudan to accept what's not in their national interest and their people's interest. But we have to reach a compromise. As the Secretary General of the United Nations said, there need to be a compromise solution. There need to be open dialogue and a compromise solution. Anyway, on the 16th, we'll know where the Council is heading when they vote. But it remains that what the U.S. is planning to do, how the State Department, the White House, going to decide on the level of their involvement. I don't know how far the Biden administration is willing to go along this route again.
That was Ahmed Fatih, managing editor of the American TV News and a UN correspondent, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Both Egypt and Sudan worry about the dam's impact on their water resources. Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry called it an existential threat to his country. On the other hand, Ethiopia needs the electricity for its growing population. Inger Andersen, executive director of the United Nations Environment Program, told the council meeting she believes an agreement is still possible, but that trust, transparency, and open engagement will be needed. In the weeks ahead, France will begin reconfiguring its military presence in the Sahel region of West Africa, where it has worked with the Sahel nations to fight Islamist militants. Speaking after a virtual summit with leaders of Burkina Faso, Mali, Chad, and Mauritania, French President Emmanuel Macron said France would start closing its military bases in northern Mali this year. The region has confronted Islamist insurgents, communal violence, and political instability for several years. France has more than 5,000 troops in the region to aid what are known as the G5 Sahel nations. Macron and France's foreign ministers say France will stay engaged in the region, but its participation will change format. South Sudan today marks the 10th anniversary of its independence from Sudan. It's a low-key commemoration in large part because of restrictions to contain the spread of COVID-19. But also for many people, independence has not brought peace nor economic stability to the world's newest nation. In a speech marking the day, President Salva Kiir pledged he would not return the country to war. 2 years after independence, the country became engulfed in a bitter civil war that cost nearly 400,000 lives and displaced millions of people. The war began after Kiir and his deputy Riek Machar had a falling out, and Kiir accused Machar of plotting a coup. After several attempts, the warring parties reached a peace agreement in 2018 and have begun to implement it again with Kiir as president and Machar as vice president. Still, as this man in Juba notes, insecurity remains. He told Sheila Pony with VOA's South Sudan in Focus program that for him, the independence anniversary means little.
It doesn't necessarily mean there is something to celebrate because we entered into a serious conflict that has brought the development efforts down. So what I can say, it means that we are just commemorating a day. We are just trying to remind us that on this day, we have got independent. But the real meaning of independent, we have not actually experienced it, and we don't actually know what does it mean exactly by being independent, because economically we are seeing our country is getting down. We don't see anything that can make us proud of our country as a nation.
This woman in Yei State told Daniel Friday with our South Sudan in Focus team that in some ways the country is no better off than it was before independence.
I'm feeling frustrated because right now we are living in fear in our own country, and we call it an independent country. Because since independence, we don't have even any liberty called independence. Our country has been fighting the day it got its independence. What independence is that? We need a state that will give us the freedom. Until when people start to change the ruling of this country and the system of economic system, education, security, all these things, when they start to change development, then that's when I'll call South Sudan is independent. But right now, we are living worse than before when we got our independence.
But many people see hope for the future and are grateful for independence. This woman in Juba told Manyang David Mayar in Juba, the world's youngest country, is like a family facing struggles.
I'm very happy to celebrate the independence of South Sudan, which is going to happen on 9th of July. And I'm happy of it, and it's going to make it 10 years, which means we are growing. So we need peace. That's the only thing we are praying for. And let the youth celebrate with the peace and harmony. You know, in life, even if at home, sometimes they're struggling. So the same thing in South Sudan, struggling. So we hope for the best, that one day, one time, it will be okay.
The country faces many challenges economically. Years of fighting have left it with battered infrastructure and declining revenue. Its problems have worsened because of drought, communal violence, and the pandemic. The United Nations estimates more than 7 million people in the country face acute food security, about 60% of the population. More than 3 million are displaced. Today, the UN Human Rights Agency called for an international commitment to help the displaced return to their homes and to improve living conditions in the country. Former South African President Jacob Zuma's last-ditch effort to get out of jail has been tossed out by the country's high court. The ruling, according to the French news agency AFP, marks the latest judgment to go against Zuma. He just began a 15-month term for contempt of court as the most dramatic chapter yet in his journey from a respected anti-apartheid activist to a politician tainted by charges of corruption, which he denies. The corruption inquiry is examining allegations that Zuma allowed three Indian-born businessmen, Atul, Ajay, and Rajib Gupta, to plunder state resources and peddle influence over government policy. He and the Gupta brothers, who fled South Africa after Zuma was ousted, deny any wrongdoing. Zimbabwe's COVID-19 vaccine rollout is picking up steam, with 2 million doses arriving from China yesterday. More is on the way as the government tries to foster herd immunity to fend off a fast-growing third wave of the coronavirus. Reporter Kuzaza Nawashi has the details.
Finance Minister Mthuli Ncube briefed the media upon receiving the vaccines at the airport.
We were receiving 2 million doses, as we had promised last week. So they are here. We can now really go full throttle in terms of the blitz vaccination program that is being rolled out by the government through the Minister of Health.
Dr. John Mangwiro is the Deputy Minister of Health. He says interest in the vaccine is encouraging.
The arrival of these 2 million doses is the way forward. The 500,000 that arrived last week has been consumed so fast. I was in Marsh West over the weekend. The uptake is massive, and we hope Zimbabweans continue to do that.
Ncube says more is in the pipeline.
Next week, on Thursday, we'll be back here. Hope to see you again. We're receiving another 1.5 million doses next Thursday. As of today, we have taken another decision that end of July, we're going to buy and receive another 2 million doses. So we're determined to go on to this blitz program. We're determined to reach that herd immunity target of 60% of our population being vaccinated as speedily as possible.
He adds that the vaccination drive is helping the country in many ways.
The vaccination program is not just about saving lives. It is also about saving the economy. Because when your people have been vaccinated, when employees have been vaccinated, when citizens have been vaccinated, it's easier for government to open up all aspects of the economy. So it is also about economic recovery.
In the past 2 weeks, the lockdown has been tightened twice and could soon include tougher restrictions, which has helped inspire the new high uptake of the vaccine. For VOA, this is Kudzai Shinawa.
Zimbabwe's government says it is delaying school reopenings by 2 weeks, but will proceed with its plans, which educators and parents call ill-timed given the current surge of COVID-19 cases. Adigando gives us more on the story.
The government says the Minister of Health and Child Care is coordinating with the Minister of Primary and Secondary Education to facilitate a safe resumption of lessons. It says contingency measures include inspections to check preparedness, adequate wash, water sanitation and hygiene, access and training and PPE gear for staff. Government officials have talked about introducing a blend of face-to-face classroom learning, remote learning at home and in communities, and alternative learning platforms such as e-learning, radio and television. Critics point out that the Ministry of Higher and Tertiary Education stopped face-to-face lectures at tertiary institutions when several were hit by COVID-19 infections last week. Official figures put the number of COVID cases at 17,499 as of July the 8th. Observers say thousands more are likely infected and unable to take the expensive tests, let alone visit medical facilities. A batch of 2 million doses of vaccine arrived today, and the government says more is on the way, but that time is needed to reach the goal of herd immunity. Teacher unions and parents have reacted to government plans to reopen schools with alarm. The 35,000-member Agricultural Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, ATUS, cites industrial grievances and inadequate, and in some cases, non-existent preparations. Obed Masaraure from the Agricultural Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe speaks.
They are not ready to go back to work until the salary crisis is resolved. They are further scared that going back to work obviously will put them in harm's way with regard to contracting COVID-19, since our schools are not safe and they are not ready to adhere to standard operating procedures. We have conducted a survey recently asking our members whether they are ready or not to go back to work. Over 95% of these teachers are not ready to go back to work. Government itself is not consulting anyone. They are going ahead and unilaterally declaring that they want to open schools. They've never consulted us. They are seized with this command culture, the command attitude.
Masaraori says that teachers have expressed a desire to continue to mobilize for a series of job actions to have their issues attended to. Parents, on another hand, say they feel the government is not reliable. Pamituso has two kids in primary school in Blawayo.
Let's look at the face-to-face. They say they are going to put sanitizers in schools. There were no sanitizers. They say they are going to vaccinate staff. Teachers, they were not vaccinated. So I don't think they have the capacity to put those things in place before they open. Where my mom kids learn? As parents, we had to foot our own resources to buy sanitizers and some. There was nothing, completely nothing, except for the equipment which we mobilized these parents. It's better that they stay at home.
Meanwhile, Progressive Teachers Union of Zimbabwe issued a test statement saying the government plans are not pragmatic given the reality on the ground. Takawa Firajo speaks.
The government has no capacity to test all the pupils and all the teachers as well as ancillary staff. We have about 136,000 teachers, almost 6 million pupils, and also about 50,000 ancillary staff. So to allow such conglomeration of people in schools without testing is suicidal and genocidal. And apart from that, we are aware that government operation standards have not been followed. Pupils are actually young, and a lot of them mingle during break time. So if we are really giving restrictions for adults, we cannot be there for reckless to open schools for minors who cannot fully comprehend the effects of COVID.
The government, through the Minister of Information, Broadcasting and Publicity, has said its plans are in order. Critics say, however, that's evidence of a deaf ear to reason and facts. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Blamayo.
Malawi has also reintroduced strict COVID-19 measures aimed at curbing surging cases. This as the government announced Wednesday that the country has entered the third wave of the pandemic. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The Presidential Task Force on COVID-19 says the decision comes in response to a recent sharp rise of 3,000 new cases in June that has resulted in 60 deaths. Kumbize Kandodo Chiponda is the co-chairperson of the Presidential Task Force.
Just of yesterday, the last 24 hours, we did 1,584 tests. Of those, we had 309 new cases. We had 20 admissions in the last 24 hours. Unfortunately, we had 3 deaths. Our data indicates that we're experiencing a resurgence of COVID-19 in our country, and this indicates that we are in the third wave of the pandemic.
The restrictions include a ban on political rallies and on sports fans' access to stadiums, a limit on gatherings of not more than 50 people, and a curfew from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. Schools will remain open, but those who test positive have to be separated from health students and will not attend classes for 14 days in order to assess the situation. Kandodo also says funeral gatherings have been restricted to 10 people.
We discourage vigils when it comes to funeral, because we have noted that one of the super spreaders of COVID-19, it is the funerals. Most people that have gotten COVID-19 when they had gone to attend a funeral. It is not necessary from the dead body, no, but because of the people who gather together to mourn our beloved one.
The measures come at a time when Malawi faces the shortages of COVID-19 vaccines. Statistics show that Malawi has only vaccinated about 400,000 people. The figure represents about 1% of the total vaccinations it needs to reach the herd immunity of 60%. But Kandodo says that the country is expected to receive about 200,000 AstraZeneca vaccines and a COVAX vaccine sharing facility in the next 2 weeks. Health rights campaigners have welcomed the restrictions, but fear the siege will continue unless the government introduces measures to enforce the restrictions. Maziko Matemba is the executive director for Health and Rights Education Program.
This was expected, that we will have these new regulations. This is coming at the background as well, where we have a benchmark of 5% positivity rate. But I think the onus is on the public to adhere to these measures.
The government says it has deployed military to help enforce those measures. Lamik Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehayus Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yaparo, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.